Part 3. Swine House. Chapter 9. I fell into Mars on the back of a rock. There were two other soldiers next to me. Each was squeezed onto a single-person dropship that was not much larger than the surface suits we had on underneath. The chrysalis-shaped dropships were attached to the rock at the head end only, with their tapering tails projecting into space. They were black on black, sheltering on the rear face of the rock as its leading side approached Mars. There was a fourth dropship beside the ones we wore, empty for now. I looked around, wriggling against the tight binding of my acceleration restraints. The sun was in my eyes, dimmed to a tolerable brightness by my visor's filters. Even in the full blaze of it, though, our dropships were chunks of featureless black, nearly devoid of detail or defined form. A spray of status graphics framed my visor as systems woke up or rebooted from the long sleep. I reviewed them with a quick, thorough eye. All was well with my body, suit, and dropship. The status update from our mission planners showed that the second phase of the operation had been executed without incident. A defection capsule had come in ahead of the rock's trajectory, and instead of shooting it down, we had allowed that one to slip through, quite deliberately, by arranging our own orbital guns to fail in their interception. Heartbeat analysis of the defection capsule indicated six recruits. They were already down on Mars. Had been so for just under a week. Our thermal scans showed that the capsule had survived its re-entry and touchdown and appeared to be keeping its occupants alive. But there had been no movement from them, no attempt to leave, and no attempt by any other conjoiner forces to reach them from the mother nest. They would come, though. I was perfectly sure of that. Galliano would find that capsule far too tempting a prize to ignore. My suit established a short-range comms web with the two occupied dropships. From their biomedical feeds, I saw that the other two soldiers were also emerging from hibernation. I sipped on a drinking tube, wetting my lips and throat, then tried to speak.
Hope? Charity?
Their answers came back a moment later, groggy but clear.
"I'm here, Faith,"
Hope said.
"Me too,"
Charity said. "Good. Welcome back." I omitted to add, "to a mission that will likely kill us all." No reminder was needed. The exact probabilities of our individual deaths might not be known to any of us, but none of us were under any illusions. This was an extremely high-risk endeavor, with no possibility of cover or reinforcements if anything went wrong. You'll have the same status update as me, even if you haven't yet digested it. I'll summarize. A DC lander's gone in, six up. Dust down 800 clicks north of our projected LZ. Been sitting there for 6 days. Spiders haven't made a move on it.
Think they've sniffed a trap?
Hope asked. No. Why should they? It's a legitimate defection bid that only just made it through our screens. It doesn't become a trap until we touch it. Until then, it's all that it seems. And they will move on it eventually. The only reason they haven't gone in already is instinctive caution and an understanding that they don't need to rush. But we'll give them an incentive.
Do we have a reference for our rendezvous point?
Charity asked. Most favored location is a muskie camp. 200 clicks south of the capsule. One of us is likely to arrive several hours ahead of the others. Whoever it is, secure the hideout and begin systems inventory after sweeping for spider traps.
As if we'd forget,
Hope said. You'll be battered and bruised from the impact and strung out and sleep-deprived from 72 hours hard marching. Nothing in the simulations will feel as bad as the real thing. Hope laughed.
Well, that's encouraging.
Look on the bright side, I answered. Between then and now, all you have to do is survive riding down to the planet on the back of an exploding asteroid.
I'm ready,
Charity said. She sounded as if she meant it, too. I admired her for that. She was a prime asset to the Coalition. Brave, single-minded, resourceful, selfless in her adherence to the anti-conjoiner cause. No one knew what went on in the heads of spiders better than this gifted young woman from psychosurgical ops. It was to her credit that she had been so willing to volunteer for the operation. Or, to put it more bluntly, not to devolunteer herself once her suitability had been identified. I almost wished I knew her actual name. Glass disengaged the dark drive, then slipped into the cover of the procession of corpses still orbiting Yellowstone. 10,000 habitats, thousands of larger ships, tens of thousands of smaller ones had been turned into a garland of ashes. There were about 3,000 more or less recognizable habitats, but even so they were blasted, airless, and tumbling out of control. The rest was rubble. The rubble of miniature worlds, light hugger hulls, in-system vehicles, people. Glass was attentive. Traces kept appearing on her displays. Spikes and waveforms and gabbling eruptions of binary code. I shifted in my acceleration couch, trying to find a position where my bones ached a little less. What are we looking for?
Something with a pulse,
she answered in a low voice, as if there was a risk of being overheard.
Ideally, something with a pulse that talks back.
I thought we'd passed the point of being cryptic with each other. Glass gave a small shrug.
There are things here that aren't totally dead. Bits of ship that still have some residual functionality left in them.
Habitats with housekeeping devices that are still running on minimal power, even though the rest of the habitat is a shell.
Space traffic beacons, still putting out transponder codes.
And this helps us how, exactly?
Some of these things are still sending out localization pulses, just as if it's business as usual. Range-finding sweeps, requests for identification, approach authorization, and so on. It's like the last few flashes of electricity in a dying brain. Machine senility, but it's still activity of a kind.
You think one of these signals may be from the ship that was meant to meet us inside John the Revelator?
Not necessarily. But if they were here at all, they may have been picked up on a tracking system and their movements logged. If I can find a tracking device and interrogate its memory, I'll be able to tell when they arrived.
She paused, biting her lower lip.
But so far these systems aren't responding in kind.
You're talking back to them. After all the trouble we've gone to not to be noticed, isn't that a little risky?
My, you really are a warrior, aren't you?
Her look veered between admiration and the faint, developing disappointment of the remorseful buyer.
How a man like you ever got anything done in wartime?
I'm not a soldier.
Your very name says otherwise. When you were small, your brother, when he and you used to play games in the sand dunes near your home, your brother called you War, for short. It's mentioned in one of the military biographic files. A puff piece about both of you being promoted to Sky Marshal. Isn't that sweet? He saw what you were to become.
You're insane.
She considered. Well, it's possible. If by sane we mean operating in the functionally predictable attractor volume of mental phase space, I'm definitely not that.
Glass gave a kitten-like shudder, as if the idea of being normal was almost viscerally repulsive.
But what I'm also not is reckless, dear War. Those comms we were discussing are all minimal energy, extreme tight beam. Since I'm mimicking the same signals protocols, any backscatter will just look like accidental leakage from the same conversation that's been going on here for decades. The trouble is, nothing is showing signs of...
Glass slowed, narrowing the black pools of her eyes at one of the readouts. You were about to say?
Until now, nothing's answered my requests for an internal data inventory. Probably means most of these transmitters are useless to us, incapable of logging an event history. But this one is more promising. It's faint, but its output pulses aren't nearly so garbled as the others, and the way it's responded is in keeping with my return pulse.
It's sent you the record of movements?
No. It may need some further persuasion, but at least it seems to understand the nature of my inquiry. I won't risk further comms until we're right on top of it, though. We have to work our way further along the orbital stream.
Our course was a forced orbit, using thrust to maintain a fixed altitude above Yellowstone, while moving faster than the blasted remnants which still circled the planet at the same elevation. Glass fired the engines in sparing bursts, never for too long, and when she had the opportunity, she used any large, relatively solid-looking mass as a cover for our course changes. After 20 nervous minutes, Scythe chimed with an alert, a warning that the concentration of masses ahead of us was denser than anything we had been picking through so far. Glass slowed our approach, reducing our relative speed to no more than a kilometre per second compared with the average motion of the orbital flow.
"I don't know how big the largest structures were," Glass said, in a rare admission of ignorance, "but several of them seemed to be moving in a fixed formation rather than following independent orbits. I don't know why. We'll have to push into that concentration, one way or the other. The beacon I'm looking for seems to be embedded in the same group of ruins."
"We could look for another beacon."
"We have already searched quite thoroughly. This is the only promising candidate."
We drifted between the black icebergs of gored and disemboweled habitats, the spaces between them slowly narrowing. From a range of 10 kilometres, the structures remained distant, abstract forms, with only traces of their former shapes. Here was a ruptured cylinder, blown wide at one end like a stoppered cannon. Here was the arc of a space wheel, severed along its rim. Here was a half-shattered globe, its guts long since spilled. I thought of the millions who might have called these worlds home, the lives that had been spent within their warm, comfortable cores. Scythe put out another alert, a different tone this time.
"What is it?"
Glass studied a readout, bit her lower lip in concentration, wore the glazed look that told me she was in intense dialogue with her ship, then undid her seat restraint.
"Wait here. I'll be back in a moment."
"Not the ideal time for a toilet break, Glass. Couldn't you try holding it in?"
"If you knew the things I am holding in, you'd be a little more circumspect with your attempts at humour."
When she returned a minute or two later, she had an object clutched between her hands. It was a blunt-ended cylinder, about the size of a small oxygen tank. The two beveled ends were thick metal plugs, flickering with lights. In between was a glass-walled container giving off a pale violet glow. Something floated in the centre of that glow, a black dot.
"Know thy enemy. You'll have seen their actions from afar, I imagine. But it's quite a different thing to hold extinction between your hands."
Glass passed the cylinder to me as if it were haunted or cursed, and I, the gift's hapless, doomed beneficiary.
"Of course we saw their actions," I said quietly. "Before or after you left human civilization?
A little of both."
Though the cylinder was weightless, I still felt the mass of its armoured sides and powerful containment mechanisms. I had understood, without asking, that the black dot was an inhibitor machine, a piece of wolf, or, in some sense, a wolf entire. Magnified, I would have seen a cube of perfect blackness. More accurately, I would have seen either a square or a hexagon, depending on the viewing angle, since the three-dimensional nature of inhibitor cubes was impossible to perceive. Those surfaces and edges were as slippery to light as an event horizon.
"What happened on the Salmasis to make you choose AU Microscopii as your destination? That can't ever have been the intended destination when the ship set out."
"It wasn't," I said guardedly. "When we left, the rumours of war were already about, but it was confined to a relatively small number of worlds and systems, and many believed it would burn out soon enough. That some revenant alien machines could never defeat the civilization that had already survived the melding plague and numerous wars of its own. So some of us thought there was hope, that all we had to do was regroup and fight back, and we could do that from one of the worlds where there was already a human presence.
And yet, the plan was abandoned."
Mid-voyage, the captain and crew thawed a quarter of the passenger complement and raised the others to baseline consciousness. We were pulled, like good demarchists. By then, the Salmasis had been running into a blizzard of emergency signals, an ever-rising chorus of alarm and panic. Other ships, other worlds. The only commonality was that sooner or later all those signals got snuffed out. The wolves were emerging everywhere we looked, around every settled star. In many cases, it was perfectly clear that they had been with us all along, undetected, dormant, waiting for the moment of activation. All thoughts of a safe haven in the known systems were thrown out. We had to plot a new course to some world where humans had never trodden, and where the wolves would be least likely to look. There were many suggestions, but most of them were deemed unworkable for one reason or other. I advocated for Michael. There was resistance at first. Who wants to spend the rest of their life sheltering inside an airless, radiation-blasted lump of rock orbiting inside a rubble cloud? But one by one, the objections fell away. We could reach the system without straying too close to any of the wolf hotspots, and the circumstellar cloud and radiation environment would provide perfect cover, especially early on, as we worked to dismantle the ship.
Good, then, that you were so persuasive. That your one voice triumphed where others did not.
If we'd gone somewhere else, then perhaps we'd have made that work as well.
But you do not know.
I know that no part of Sun Hollow came easily, and that there were plenty who wanted my neck on the block for ever advocating it.
And yet, by then, you had become the de facto leader.
Glass looked at me with the sort of cold admiration one reserved for a well-tempered blade.
Just one voice, out of all those passengers, yet the one that prevailed.
Someone had to. The crew relinquished authority to a civilian settlement board. If there was a command vacuum, then I suppose I helped fill it. But it wasn't just me making those decisions like some kind of autocrat. There was Morgan Valois, too, and Rurik Tain,
the man you later shot, or attempted to shoot.
Whatever we were driven to do, Glass, it was only ever because of the wolves. I regarded the object between my hands with renewed fascination and horror. No venomous snake or spider could have filled me with more dread. I saw those transmissions when they came in. There was nothing distant or abstract about the way people were dying. Extinction isn't some bureaucratic erasure. It's screaming, suffocation, desperation, and terror. It's pain and sorrow, and the certain promise of more to come. I saw it, and swore we'd never be touched by any part of that in Sun Hollow. I swallowed, my throat suddenly dry.
I kept my promise, right to the end.
A promise that drove you to the brink of mass murder. Oh, poor Brother War.
Enough, I said angrily. You weren't there, down in those caverns. You have no right to judge me.
Oh, I have every right. Shouldn't the executed be allowed an opinion on her executioner?
I said I'd kill you, Glass. I haven't yet. I shuddered, trying to push her questions and madness out of my skull. A piece of rough-edged glass bored through the middle. This wolf, I said, focusing on the immediate practicality of the thing I held between my hands. How did it get in here? And can you really be sure it's dead? Glass sighed. I could not be sure whether it was one of modest relief or quiet disappointment that I had not allowed her to keep picking at the scabs of my past.
Scythe detected it. It fell against the hull and was immediately recognized for what it is. Recognized and quarantined, then brought inside for examination. To your second point, it isn't dead. If it were, we would not see it. When they die, the cubes collapse and you're left with a tiny remnant of dust. The fact that the cube is still present and that it triggered the ship's countermeasures proves that it's still alive, but more than likely in a dormant or weakened state, and therefore of no immediate risk to us. May I?
Gingerly, Glass took the containment device back from me and made some adjustment to the controls in the end.
Watch. I'll reduce the containment strength. Are you mad? I said reduce it, not turn it off.
Glass's fingers played the controls as if they were the buttons of an accordion. The inhibitor machine swelled, no longer a dot now, but a black speck about the size of a skinflake. Still, I could see no structure to it, no hint of depth. Glass allowed it to grow a little further. A grain of rice, then a sultana, then a small blank-faced gaming die.
Enough, I whispered.
The containment device quivered in her grip. Red lights pulsed on the ends.
Oh, but there's some life in you, isn't there?
Glass let the cube increase further still in size. Now a fat die, now a child's play block. The violet radiance stammered. The red lights were all lit continuously, the device straining to hold back the cube's desire to expand.
You were sleeping until you hit me, weren't you? Sleeping and nearly forgetting the thing you are, the thing you are meant to be. But now it's all coming back to you.
She lofted the device until the cube was level with her eyes.
Such determination, such an evil, earnest need to do your duty, such selflessness.
She snapped her fingers, and a white flash pulsed out of the device's sides. I blinked, an afterimage floating before me. As my vision cleared, I saw that the cylinder was empty, the violet field dimming. Glass opened a little port in the base and out squirted a grey haze of fine ash. She pinched some of it onto her fingers, then held them up to my nose.
Smell it. That's what extinction smells like.
Fireworks.
I've never smelled fireworks.
But they say everyone has a different idea about that smell. It races up the olfactory nerve and finds something in each of us. Some memory or connection to death. I take it the dust is safe.
Inert matter. When they collapse, when an external force overrides their field-generating capability, they're careful not to leave anything useful behind. Anything an inferior species might be able to reverse-engineer and turn against them. So yes, safe.
That really wasn't necessary, Glass.
On the contrary, it was more than necessary. You've seen the worst of what they can do via those transmissions. The screams and the sorrow. I've drunk my share of that as well. And you know the slower, more agonizing sort of terror that lies in the act of hiding. Hiding for years or decades, never daring to make a single mistake. That terror that seeps into every thought, every dream. The terror that underlines every pleasure. The terror that negates hope. The terror that stains every joy with the knowledge that it may all soon end, and horribly. But this is the counterpoint, the truth that we must also carry within us. The understanding that for all they have done to us, for all they have brought us to the whimpering edge of annihilation, they're not invulnerable, that we can kill them, and we shall.
Glass's words resonated within me for a second or two before I answered. Perhaps we can kill them, but only when they're kind enough to arrive in ones or twos, and be half asleep when they do.
There'll be other means. There are other means.
Glass set aside the containment device. Its purpose, to rattle me or inspire me or both, evidently served.
Now at least we know that the wolves are still here, albeit in some state of dormancy.
Scythe can rebuff them in small numbers, and without drawing too much attention to itself.
But we would be advised not to run into any large aggregations.
And if we do?
We should be well to have found ourselves a wolf killer.
Glass was silent for a moment.
Which, with your assistance, we shall.
The habitats crowded nearer. The distances between them narrowed to mere hundreds of meters. It turned dark in those canyon-like spaces, and I had a strong urge to turn back. But Glass was still following the trace from the beacon, and she would not be deterred.
Do you see?
Glass said suddenly. See what?
Black filaments, black structures connecting these drifting hulks. That's why they're following the same orbit. They're tethered.
She ruminated for a moment.
I don't think it's wolf material. If they meant to engulf and assimilate these ruins, they'd have done so in a very short while.
There's no need to, not with so much raw matter elsewhere in the system, there for the taking. So what is it?
Something indigenous, which has broken out of control. An opportunistic regrowth of plague strains, perhaps, erupting from private vivaria, or the hidden niches where it was never entirely eliminated.
Or something spawned deliberately, some self-replicating biological or cybernetic process, now enjoying unfettered growth, far beyond the whims of its creators. Wouldn't the wolves have come back to stop it?
I doubt that it concerned them enough to go to such trouble. These are maggots.
Maggots?
The wolves have taken apart civilizations before.
Many of them must have produced unregulated end-stage growth patterns, not unlike these forms. It's a marker for morbidity, a highly integrated society going through its terminal spasms. She waited a moment, then brought up some synthetic image of the intricate, net-like structures binding the drifting ruins. Blue lines, radiating and intersecting.
What does that remind you of?
Cobwebs. And where there are cobwebs?
Then we shan't delay.
The beacon is just ahead, loosely adhered to the outer wall of the nearest habitat.
Go to the suiting room.
By the time we begin station keeping, you will be ready to leave. Can't you send out some of your robots instead?
The servitors can't move around very efficiently in vacuum, whereas the suits can. And if I am going to commit a suit, I might as well give it an autonomous capability.
So glad I get to be an autonomous capability, I said. The crossing to the beacon was no test for the suit, just a quick jaunt across a couple of 100 meters of open space. The robot had delivered a self-burrowing probe to the airlock in time for my departure, and now it spooled out behind me, trailing a hair-thin line back to Scythe. The main part of the probe was a squat, dual-handled cylinder with a battery of gripping, cutting, and drilling devices set into its end. Glass had assured me that it would know what to do. The space I drifted through was the canyon-like gap between two habitats that had come near to each other, but hadn't quite fused. The two surfaces were pitted and scarred, ready to close in like a pair of vast, rotten molars. Their surfaces stretched away in all directions, leaving only narrow slots above and below. The blackened and scabbed walls gave off no light of their own, but Yellowstone was below, fully illuminated by Epsilon Eridani. Some of that reflected radiance found its way into the crevice between the habitats, bouncing around and casting a sepia tinge on the ship, my suit, the walls of the habitats, and the cobwebbing that stretched between the walls. Glass had loaded a navigation trace into the suit, homing in on the beacon, but it still took me a minute to recognize my target. The beacon was a dodecahedron, about 4 meters across, with panels made of some lustrous substance. It was partially enclosed by cobwebbing binding it to the wall, but not so thoroughly that it was impossible to reach. The cobwebbing thickened as I neared. The suit wanted to charge on through, but I slowed it and switched to a fully manual approach. Eventually, I had to tuck in my arms and legs to squeeze through the narrowest passages. As I made contact with the beacon, I was able to stretch out again and plant my feet on a ledge-like protuberance of the wall, then rest a hand on one of the dodecahedron's panels. We knew the beacon to be functional, so it was no surprise to see the occasional pulse of light flicker beneath the panel. It was the only continuing process I had seen anywhere around Yellowstone, the only indication that our civilization had been capable of more than mute ruins. Before continuing, I looked back through the tangle of cobwebs, reassuring myself that Scythe was still there. Glass had said nothing since my departure, not even sending a signal through the line, but I imagined she was studying my progress. I positioned the cutting face of the probe on the nearest and least obstructed panel. At the last instant before contact, the probe jerked from my grip, fastening itself on. With my palm against another part of the beacon, I felt a constant, grinding vibration. This went on steadily for a minute or two, then abated. Faint tremors and bumps came from the beacon, but by now I guessed that the probe had dug its fangs beneath the outer armor and was working through the softer tissue of logic arrays and memory registers. The flickering lights responded in kind, the beacon registering its distress. I watched the lights warily, willing this to be over and done with. So long as it was just those lights, we were not in too much trouble. They were surely too faint for any trace of them to make its way out of the canyon. The beacon jolted hard, nearly knocking me off my perch. The probe must have broken through some inner membrane, or ruptured some pressure vessel or energy cell. Everything stopped. The beacon was still, the probe pausing in its efforts. Glass, I began to say, invoking her name without contacting her. I saw the probe twitch as it resumed its work, sending a kink back through the data line. and the beacon screamed. Every other one of its panels was flashing a brilliant, blinding pink. It was putting out a clangorous emergency tone across a wide spread of radio frequencies detected by my suit and amplified into my helmet. I had no doubt that the signal was strong enough to reach halfway around Yellowstone, and probably far beyond it. I moved to the probe and tried to detach it. It was rooted in place, impossible to budge. It was still drilling. "Glass!" I shouted, content to use the suit to ship channel now that we were already making so much electromagnetic noise. "You've triggered something. Make it stop!"
"No, not yet. The data is beginning to flow back to Scythe.
The wolves will hear this.
The signal has already done its damage. Nothing would be gained by stopping now.
We will just have to trust that the wolves interpret the signal as a natural consequence of the processes going on among these ruins.
Besides, I am exploring a number of promising override pathways."
"Explore faster!"
The beacon silenced. The pink panels stopped flashing. It had happened so suddenly that it was nearly as shocking as when it had begun. The probe remained in place. I imagined that it had pushed a fatal load of venom into its prey and was now sucking it dry from within. I watched it for a few more seconds, wondering if I had any further part to play in the operation. If I went back directly, Scythe ought to be able to reel in the probe without my assistance. The beacon moved again, shifting languidly in its nest of cobwebs. But it was not the beacon that had initiated that motion. It was the cobwebs themselves, stirring. I froze for a moment, surveying the scene around me. What had been stillness was starting to creep and ooze. The sepia light exaggerated the encroachment of 1,000 shadows as the cobwebs tightened and unraveled and slid over themselves, according to some huge, slow, coordinated plan. I pushed myself off the ledge, into free space. The probe could take its chances. I wanted to get away from the area where the cobwebs were at their densest. They were already wrapping around the beacon more thoroughly than before, cocooning it in a tightening weave of slithering threads. Glass had set up the suit to home in on the beacon, but she had left it to me to plot my own way back to Scythe. I could still make out the black absence of the ship, just barely. Like a message that had been scribbled over several times, it was becoming harder to keep my attention on it as the cobwebs crisscrossed the space before me. They were moving now, as well as the ones near the beacon, and with steadily more vigor. Some were as thick as tree trunks, flexing or uncoiling with the quiet, hungry purposefulness of pythons. "Glass," I said, fear overcoming my inclination to keep silent. "We've started something. You'd better move Scythe well away from this area."
"I'm not finished. Stay with the probe, in case it detaches."
"To hell with the probe. I'm already on my way back. But I'd like the ship to be in one piece when I arrive."
"This was your one test. The one thing I asked you to do."
"You mean the thing you demanded I do?"
"Get back," Glass hissed.
Something snagged my ankle, jerking me to a halt before the suit had gathered any useful speed. A black tendril had hooked me, forming a loop in itself and tightening. I thrashed and kicked, loosening myself at what felt like the last possible moment before the loop closed off any possibility of escape. Perhaps the suit would have had some countermeasure in reserve, but it was nothing I was prepared to stake my life on. I gunned the jets, breathing hard. The line still stretched all the way back to Scythe, a fine thread catching the last golden blush of Yellowstone before the face below us was swallowed by night. The ship was clearer in my view now, less than 200 meters away, but the cobwebs were exploring it, brushing against its hull. Glass must have known, but still she was delaying departure, anxious to drink the last drop of data from her prize. If there had been something in my suit capable of cutting that line, I would have done so without hesitation. The line went slack, and then tautened again.
"The probe is returning," Glass said. "Grab it and ride it home. It will be quicker than coming in on suit power."
I steered close to the line and looked back just in time to see the drilling head speeding towards me, hauled in by the accelerating winch. I only had one chance to seize it, and the velocity difference was already 4 or 5 meters per second. The jolt might have torn my arms out of my sockets if they were not protected by the suit. I held on, my breath rasping in my throat, and then a secondary concern presented itself. Glass was winching me in so fast, I was in danger of smashing into the rear wall of the airlock. At the last instant, I released the winch, and the suit instigated its own anti-collision procedure before I could begin to command the thrusters. I slowed hard, but remained conscious, and then drifted almost peaceably into the lock. By the time the door began to close, we were already moving. But not so quickly as Glass must have desired. The cobwebs had furled the round scythe, and now they were consolidating their embrace. Chapter 10. As we slipped free, I think even Glass understood that she had cut matters too fine for comfort. I hoped that was worth it.
So do I, because I'd hate to rely on you twice. Fortunately, it won't be necessary to look for any other beacons. I have what I needed from this one. A ship entered the ruins 6 years ago. Its point of origin isn't determined, but there's no reason to think it didn't come from the Lighthugger.
How can you be sure it wasn't some other ship, and nothing to do with your allies?
Because there aren't any other ships. This is the only logged movement in or out of the wider system in 53 years. No one has come near enough to be picked up by the beacon. Before you pin all your hopes on that one entry, it's them. The pattern fits. They make a direct approach to Yellowstone, then are lost in the atmosphere. 2 weeks later, the beacon picks up a vessel of the same general profile leaving Yellowstone, but they never continue back to John the Revelator.
Something still got to them, then. Perhaps they ran into those cobwebs, or some more of those wolf cubes latched onto them, more than they could defend against.
I don't think so.
I decided that I much preferred Glass when she was certain of things. If I was going to be forced into cooperation with a merciless, killing angel, I wanted her to be entirely free of doubt. Doubt was for the rest of us. Does the beacon have anything to say? My question must not have seemed entirely imbecilic to her, because she answered in a surprisingly civil manner.
It doesn't keep a detailed fix on their movements. It's impossible for a single beacon to sweep all of the ruins at the same time, with Yellowstone sitting in the middle. But there's nothing about the way they left the atmosphere that makes me think they had difficulties with their ship. They seemed to be moving towards a small body in one of the outer orbits, just before the trace goes cold. They don't reappear. I think they must be still waiting in orbit, but well enough concealed that there's no way to pick up a locator trace.
I know you want them to be alive, but 6 years is a long time to sit around for no good reason.
They must have determined that it was too dangerous to make the agreed rendezvous. Perhaps wolf activity was heightened until recently, or they were aware of some other threat.
Glass squeezed her fist, seizing an idea and crushing it until its juices flowed.
They're waiting for us. They knew we'd follow their trail as best we could, but they can't advertise their location. They have to rely on us finding them, using the beacon records.
All right. Supposing we run with this. After 6 years, can we narrow down their location?
It should not tax us. Even if there are a number of candidates, Scythe can search them quite efficiently with its remotes, looking for stray emissions or thermal noise. They can't reach out to us across any sort of distance, but if we can get very close, they may announce their presence.
This is going to be like playing hide-and-seek in a darkened room.
Except the hunter and hunted both have sharpened daggers, and each has reason to be nervous.
With that reassurance, Glass flashed a fierce grin.
I have the search volume. It's a little further around the orbit, but Scythe can narrow down the candidate list as we travel. The game's afoot, dear war. No reason not to start playing.
It took us 3 hours to skulk our way further around Yellowstone, using the ruins for cover where it was prudent to do so. Now and then we saw drifting clusters of habitats, or parts of habitats, tethered together by something similar to the cobwebs, indicating that the growth had taken root in multiple sites. I was relieved when Glass showed no inclination to curiosity. There was enough to keep our nerves on edge without indulging in dangerous sightseeing. Scythe was detecting and neutralizing wolf cubes every few minutes as they rained against our hull. These were either lone cells or microaggregations of less than a dozen, and in such small numbers were not a serious threat. In all cases, the cubes were destroyed before they showed any tendency to begin the assimilation of local matter, confirming that they were in the same state of dormancy as the first. But the threat of the wolves lay in coordinated action, and it would only take one cube to wake up sufficiently to send an alert back to a larger concentration in the ruins or nearby. This was not speculation. It was a pattern that had been documented time and again as the wolves picked our civilization apart. Between them, Glass and Scythe had narrowed down the possible hiding places to three bodies, all following a similar orbit. When we were 1,000 kilometers out from each candidate, Scythe launched a drone. One object was a ruptured cylinder, blasted open at both ends, so we could see right through it without any special sensors. The interior had been landscaped, shaped with lakes, rivers, waterfalls, little hills and hamlets, linked by meandering roads, better suited to mules and carts than high-speed travel. Only a grey death mask of this one-time Eden remained. The habitat must have depressurized quickly, its waters boiling into vacuum and its trees torn from their roots. A few petrified trunks were still floating in the core. A ship could have parked within the gutted shell, but unless it had disguised itself in the remains of the hamlets or dug its way into the thin skin between the inner and outer walls, the drone should have found it. The second candidate offered a little more cover. It was a sphere that had only been punctured at one point, meaning that most of the interior was still well concealed. But the drone found almost nothing inside besides some broken lights and the lacy remnants of withered vegetation. Only the third candidate really offered a plausible place to hide a functioning spacecraft. Rather than a fabricated structure like the first two, this was a lump of rock that had been tunneled into and made livable. Being a boulder, it had withstood collisions and impacts that would have shattered a wheel or cylinder. That was not to say it had come through the attack unscathed, or that it would have been easy for anyone to keep living inside it. Something like an energy beam had punched a dozen clean holes right through the boulder, and the entry and exit wounds were wide enough for a small ship. Scythe wheeled around this rock, sniffing for emissions. Nothing struck, but when the drone went in and out of one of the tunnels, it picked up a slight but statistically significant excess of neutrinos. The boulder was also a little warmer than some of the surrounding bodies, although not so much that it called attention to itself. Glass summoned the drone back.
"We'll go inside. They'll know we're here, so the next move is theirs."
"I'd raise an objection," I said sourly, "but you'd only say I was worrying."
"You mustn't let Glass get under your skin,"
Glass said, commenting on herself as if she were absent. She took us in through the only hole large enough to accept a ship the size of Scythe. This was not one of the energy beam punctures. The walls on either side of us had been smoothly bored, and as we went deeper, they widened into a reception cavern. Here and there were the ghost traces of structures that might have been bracketed out from the walls, but which had now been removed. "This used to be a docking bay," I said, before Glass had a chance to voice her own opinion. "It's not something that formed by accident. There were berthing cradles here, serving racks and airlock ports. But it's all been cleaned out a long time ago, leaving just the witness marks. Perhaps a really long time ago, even before the wolves." Glass said nothing. I had come to realize that this was her silent, brooding acknowledgement that I had made a statement that was neither incorrect nor easily refutable. "It would have made a good place to dock," I went on, "but there aren't any ships. We can search the other holes, I suppose, but it could be that your probe was just picking up residual radiation from something that happened in the past."
"There's a ship near us."
"You want there to be a ship near us. That doesn't mean..." Something was happening in the back wall of the chamber. A section of what had seemed to be a seamless surface was receding into the wall, leaving a clean bored shaft behind it. The shape of the section was curious, but too deliberate to be accidental. An ellipsoidal middle, with two lobe-like extensions on either side, each tipped with a smaller ellipse of their own. Without a word, Glass advanced her ship. "It could be a trap."
"It's not a trap. It's a lock."
She glanced at me. I mean in the old-fashioned sense, rather than a thing to keep in air. It's a lock, and with a key. I understood. Scythe had exactly the right cross-section to fit into that peculiar slot that had opened up in the wall. The central ellipse was for the hull, the lobes and smaller ellipses for the conjoiner drives. Through the false view of the control room windows, I watched as the sides of the bore slipped past us. There was ample clearance to begin with, but Scythe widened near its midsection, and by the time half the ship was into the lock, the proximity alarms were informing us that we were only centimetres away from a collision. "Terrain! Terrain!" Glass silenced the alarms and pushed on blithely. She barely blinked when the ship ground against the walls.
"If we jam inside this thing, we're in trouble."
"We shan't jam. This lock has been purpose-designed for Scythe."
Disapproval clouded her face.
"It's an unnecessary flourish, but not out of keeping. It reassures me. To have engineered this lock, they must have had time and resources and the means to move matter around without attracting the wolves."
Scythe crunched to a halt, jerking us forward in our seats. We had arrived at the end of the shaft, and there was no way through. Glass touched the cold gas thrusters and began to back us up.
"What are you doing?"
"Reversing a little. Then I will deploy cutting devices. Something must have malfunctioned in the lock. The wall ahead of us is sticking at this point. If the cutters don't work, I will use limited yield energy beams or shaped charge munitions, but they may require a retreat to the first chamber."
"You're not thinking this through." Glass looked at me sharply.
"Oh, and you are?"
"You said we're the key. What's the first thing you do to a key after you've pushed it into a lock? Or have you forgotten how keys actually work?" I nodded forward. "Take us back in as far as we'll go, then use those jets to apply a rotational torque. Keys turn." Glass brooded on my answer, then appeared to find some grain of sense in it. She took us back in to the limit of the wall, kissing it more cautiously this time.
"Which way? Clockwise or anti-clockwise?"
I shrugged.
"Whichever works."
Glass applied the jets. At first, it got us nowhere. We were already tight against all the surfaces, so Scythe barely twitched before it stopped moving. Clockwise hadn't worked. Glass tried an anti-clockwise torque, and that got us no further.
"So much for your one idea."
"You give in too easily. Locks get sticky, and if this one is only meant to work for Scythe, you can be sure it won't have been operated for a long time. Waggle us around harder."
"Scythe doesn't waggle."
"Today, it does." Glass offered a wordless grunt, then set about doing what I had suggested, applying the jets first one way, then the other, with increasing force. Scythe clunking back and forth against the limits of the walls until, with a lurch, we continued rotating, the lock's barrel finally loosening. It was a clockwise turn that did it in the end, and we must have gone around more than 180 degrees before some secondary mechanism activated, causing the obstructing surface ahead of us to drop away. Scythe now had a clear path forward again. Glass advanced us, passing out of the opposite counterpart to the lock entrance into a sealed space about as large as the first chamber, but considerably further into the rock. Scythe exited the lock and floated in airless stillness and dark.
"You have your uses," Glass said.
After about a minute, lights came on. Around the walls of the chamber, 20 or so beams had activated, pinning us in a cat's cradle of light. The beams were visible in the trace gases of the maneuvering jets. They slid around the hull, examining it. Then they became still again, and a small door opened in the wall. A much smaller in-system vehicle was docked next to ours, fixed to the wall by a berthing clamp. It was dark red, with a scale-like patterning to its armour.
"Do you recognize it?"
Glass nodded once.
"That's the shuttle they brought with them from Hela, carried here in the hold of John the Revelator. It's small enough to traverse the lock, like a universal key.
It doesn't look damaged."
"Are you an expert on that design?"
"No, but I don't need to be. Is it damaged?" After a few seconds, Blas said, "It appears superficially intact."
"Thank you. I admitted no error."
"No, but I'm learning to take my victories where I can." We watched the door for several minutes, wondering if someone or something, up to and including a weapon, was going to come out of it. When it became plain that nothing of that sort was going to happen, Glass and I arrived at the unavoidable conclusion that we were meant to let ourselves in.
"I'll go," I ventured. "Then you can do the same excellent job of protecting me as you did when I went to the beacon."
"Did you come to any harm?"
"No."
"Then you've nothing to complain about. I almost am tempted to send you ahead, you know, just in case there are any traps we still have to pass. But we'll go in together. The sooner we're all acquainted, the sooner we'll gain the Gideon stones."
I nodded slowly, as if this was all reasonable. She had mentioned these stones already, but I was still none the wiser about their nature or function. "Do we go in armed?" She looked shocked.
"Where are your manners, War? That would be rude and futile. We're not here to negotiate.
They'll be relieved to see us, and fully cooperative."
"It's been a warm welcome so far. And please, stop calling me War." Glass put Scythe into safekeeping mode, and we went to the suiting bay. We carried no extra weapons or equipment with us, although I was certain that the suits had built-in self-defense capabilities. But as long as we were not flaunting weapons, I supposed we hewed to some tenuous definition of good manners. The chamber was weightless, so we drifted over the door using suit thrusters. Beyond the door was an airlock of unremarkable design, equipped with a full set of manual controls. It was spacious enough to take both of us. Glass sealed the outer door and allowed air to flood in. She looked back at Scythe through the door's small viewing port, her ship still pincered between those beams.
"Misgivings?"
I asked gently. "The faint feeling that something isn't quite right, but you can't put your finger on it? If they have these stones you need, and since their ship is intact, why didn't they find a way to get them to the Lighthugger, or at least send a message? How hard can that have been? And what, by the way, are the stones?" The airlock provided an atmosphere determined to be both breathable and absent of any harmful additives, so in the interests of further good manners, we stepped out of the suits and left them to wait by the lock. It was colder than I might have wished, wearing my shipboard clothes, but I could tolerate it for the sake of diplomacy. I rubbed my hands hard, urging blood to circulate into my fingertips. Glass seemed untroubled. Still weightless, we half-drifted and half-propelled ourselves down a connecting corridor lit by pale yellow strips. The corridor soon came to an abrupt end, with a smooth, sheer wall blocking us. I reached out to touch the wall, wanting to get some sense of its solidity. There had to be a means of getting through it. It was absurd to allow us all this way and then deny any further progress. Glass slapped my hand away before my fingers contacted the wall.
"It's moving, you fool."
"What?"
"We're only seeing a small part of a much larger moving surface, like the side of a wheel."
I stared at the wall, seeing it anew. Though it had seemed flawless before, I now realized that this was only a consequence of its motion. Now and then, a scratch or scuff passed across the width of the corridor very rapidly. I glanced back to my fingers, glad that they were still attached to me. It would not have taken much, a crack or seam in the surface, to rip them from my knuckles. "I don't understand why they'd block us this way."
"They aren't," Glass said. "Sooner or later there'll be a gap, a recess in the wall. This is the transition between the main body of the rock and some part of it made to spin for centrifugal gravity. When the gap comes around, we have to step into it."
We did not have long to wait. The gap was an interruption in the rim, a recess big enough to take at least two suited forms. It came and went in 2 or 3 seconds, then returned around again about a minute later. Glass and I looked at each other, then nodded, ready for the next opportunity. There could be no hesitation. If we mistimed our entries, we'd be crushed between the moving and stationary parts of the structure. The transition was bruising, but my bones remained unbroken. Glass had made it look easy. She was already standing, legs spread for balance, one hand against the fixed wall of the moving structure. I got up on my feet, readjusting to the presence of gravity.
It feels heavy. Not even close to a G.
Glass strode over to a circular hole in the floor, planting her feet to either side of it and peering into a yellow-lit void.
There's a ladder going down. Your weight will increase as you descend. Go ahead of me.
Why?
Because if you fall off, I don't want you dragging me down with you.
Your kind concern is noted. I made an awkward approach to the ladder, wishing there was a handhold on the floor to help, as I levered my legs into the shaft and searched for a rung. Eventually I got going and set about a steady descent, rung by rung. Glass was right. The load was steadily increasing as we moved further and further from the centrifuge's axis of rotation. But my muscles were readjusting to the imposition of gravity as well, and the two kept pace. Nice of your friends to come all the way to the front door and greet us.
There's no need. We've come this far. We'd hardly turn back at the last step. Can you see a bottom to the shaft?
I glanced down into a yellow haze of receding perspectives. Not yet. Are you going to tell me about these Gideon stones before we meet our host, or would that give you one less reason to feel superior over me? I'd hate to deprive you of one of the few small pleasures in your life. I went down a few more rungs, grunting with the effort, my palms turning sweaty. The ache in my bones was reasserting itself jealously, as if I had neglected to give it enough attention. Glass followed a short distance above me, moving with an easy, cat-like rhythm that only made my own efforts seem more labored.
They're devices. Alien technology.
Something we can use against the wolves.
Indirectly.
I don't like indirectly.
You won't like any part of it.
Glass continued her silent descent for a few more moments.
They're a defensive system, and a useful one. The creatures that made them put the stones to one use. We shall put them to another.
I was starting to see something below me. Feeling more confident now that there was less distance to fall, even as the gravity increased, I quickened my descent. A floor or platform was coming up. I jumped down the last few rungs, feeling a reckless confidence in my newly strengthened bones. With my feet on solid ground, actually a gridded floor, I stepped back to allow Glass to finish her climb. When she was still above my head, she skipped off the rungs entirely and slid down with her palms and feet skimming the ladder's side. The floor clattered under her as she landed.
"You missed your chance," she said. "You could have impaled me as I was coming down."
I dabbed my forehead in mock absent-mindedness.
I knew there was something I'd forgotten. An impaling spike. You know, I wouldn't go around putting ideas in my head. I might start noting them down for future use.
The ladder had brought us to a room no larger than an airlock. There was no sign of the ladder continuing beneath us, so I suppose we had reached the maximum radius of the centrifuge. I estimated that we were experiencing about half a gravity.
"They can't operate this wheel all the time,"
Glass said. "No matter how well engineered it all is, there'll be a heat burden. I left them with some cryo-arithmetic engines, but they can't be used continually."
They broke down.
Neither of us had spoken. A door had opened in the side of the room and a person of medium height was standing there, wearing a dark hood and gown. They had their arms by their side, but the sleeves were so long that it was impossible to say whether they carried a weapon or were empty-handed. The hood projected forward, shadowing the whole of their face.
"Lady Eric?"
Glass asked, doubtfully.
"This man with you."
The voice was deeper and raspier than Glass's.
"I take it he's the one you went all that way for."
"He's the one."
"Clavain?"
"No. The brother, as I expected."
"Not what I expected."
The hood lingered on me. I heard a sniffing sound.
"Smells musty. Smells like old meat. Smells rotten."
"He's old, but I've commenced rejuvenation measures. You should have smelled them before I began."
"You sure it's really him?"
"The gene markers don't lie, nor do the microsurgical traces. He's grown himself a new arm and a new eye, maybe several times over. swamped his own memories with blockades, so thick he doesn't even remember his real identity. Been living as a kindly old man of the people, under the name Miguel de Rita. Couldn't let the past go completely. No. A billion names he could have chosen, and he still went for one with a connection to Mars.
Glass looked at me with a little sadness.
But it's not who else he fools that matters. No one else cares. No one else remembers. He could have called himself Clavaine, and the world wouldn't have noticed. But he needed to forget who he was.
Is he coming back?
Slowly. I used reefer sleep to flood him with mnemonovores. The blockades create distinctive association structures. The mnemonovores target them preferentially, leaving authentic memories intact and help reconsolidate pathways that have been left to wither. It's not perfect, but...
There was an awkward lull. The hooded figure was still at the threshold and had made no overtures of welcome.
May we come inside, Lady Arryk?
I'm not Lady Arryk.
The figure lifted its arms, the sleeves falling back to reveal stubby, trotter-like hands with only two fingers and a thumb. It swept back the hood, disclosing a scarred, snouted face. I flinched in the first moment of recognition, realizing that we had been speaking to a hyperpig.
My name is Snowdrop, Lady Arryk's head of security. I'll decide whether you take another step inside.
I studied the map of scars that crisscrossed Snowdrop's face. One had gone right through an eye socket, but somehow spared the eye. Some teeth were missing, others yellowed with age. Wisps of white hair straggled back from a low, angled brow. Her pointed, upraised ears were scarred, swollen and ragged with long-heeled voids. They were also punctured by numerous metal rings and studs, and where her skin showed, it was a patchwork of ink, mark over mark.
If you had any doubts about our identity, you should have acted sooner, I said.
Got that wrong for a start.
Snowdrop shot Glass a quizzical look.
Are you sure he's Clavaine? Thought he was supposed to be some kind of tactical mastermind.
You had to wait until we were out of our suits and nearly defenseless,
Glass said.
There's some barrier across that door, a last line of security. Whatever it is, I can't sense it.
Then how do you know it's there?
Because I don't think you or Lady Arryk would be stupid enough not to have something.
Snowdrop gave a half-impressed cock of her head.
There's a thread of filament moving up and down the length of the doorway too quickly for your eye to detect. The mechanism is hydraulic, driven by shielded pumps. If you'd taken a step across the threshold, half of you wouldn't have made it.
She lifted her snout. Tell me how you found us here. We followed breadcrumbs,
Glass said.
John the Revelator, then the Rust Belt, then a beacon which had logged your ship movements 6 years ago.
And how was John the Revelator's state of mind?
Glass gave an indifferent shrug. All that you could expect of a barely human consciousness haunting the bowels of a plague-ravaged wreck from another century? All that you'd expect from a man born when people used chemistry to get off planets? All that you'd expect from a man whose life consists solely of grand crimes and tiny inadequate twitches of reflex atonement? All you'd expect of an 800-year-old monster? Not that any of that's a surprise. The man was more than mad before he became half-fused with his ship.
And the rest? I said.
The rest?
Snowdrop asked me, lifting an eyebrow over that scar-bisected eye. I had to rescue Glass. In return for releasing her, I promised John the Revelator that I'd find out what had happened to you. Whoever you are, he seemed fonder of you than he was of Glass.
From what I was told, he'd be fonder of most things in the universe than he is of Glass.
Snowdrop stepped back from the door.
You can come through now. I've disabled the cutter.
She called back over her shoulder.
They're clean.
We passed some test? Glass asked.
Old Stinky seems to be speaking some kind of truth.
If you'd come up from below, or worse, if you were being run by wolves, you'd never know who John the Revelator did or didn't like.
I took a breath and stepped across the threshold, pausing on the other side to make sure all of me had made it across. Then I turned around to offer a chivalrous hand to Glass. She wrinkled her nose and traversed the door without my assistance. I lowered my hand. Two thick-necked, over-muscled men appeared behind Snowdrop, wearing plated and buckled body armor and carrying Boser pistols. The men were bearded, one with long hair and the other shaven all the way to the scalp, which was a map of scars and dents, like a planet after a heavy bombardment.
"Stand down," Snowdrop murmured. "These are the incomers."
"Do you know these people?" I asked Glass.
"I don't know any of them, including her. They must be associates. Lady Arik has collected since her arrival."
"You make us sound like trinkets,"
Snowdrop countered.
"Not exactly how I see it. Or Lady Arik, for that matter."
"Is Lady Arik one of the associates you sent from Hela?" I asked. "The ally you met?" Snowdrop cocked her jaw in amusement.
"Is that how Glass tells it? That it's an equal partnership? Or did she go even further and make out she's somehow running things and Lady Arik's going along with whatever she's told?"
"Lady Arik and I arrived at a basis for cooperation," Glass stated.
"Well, that's one way of putting it,"
Snowdrop said.
"Another would be that she turned you into a weeping little puddle, and it was all you could do to beg for your life and be given a tiny part of her plan to be getting on with, like a doggy thrown a bone."
Snowdrop eyed me.
"Sorry, Stinky, if this is all news to you. I bet you think Glass is scary, but that's only 'cause you haven't met Lady Arik."
"She's well, I take it?"
Glass asked.
"6 years in this place will test anyone's will, but it's a lot better than where we came from, and she knows it."
"And her escort? The pig?"
"Oh, Pinky. He's mostly fine. I see to that."
Glass had told me next to nothing about her associates, but now at least I had some names, or partial names, and the knowledge that one was a hyperpig, like Snowdrop. Also that Lady Arik was in no way acting under Glass's direction, and that their alliance might be built on shakier foundations than I had been led to think. Who were they, beyond these names? I had no idea.
"Gentlemen,"
Snowdrop said to the two guards,
"would you mind going ahead and warning the Overlook? We're on our way up."
"You sure about that?" asked the balder of the two men, scratching at his temple. "They haven't been searched, scanned,
decontaminated?" "It's them, Amori. And if it isn't, if the wolves are good enough to impersonate living, breathing bodies, we're already in far too much trouble to do anything about it."
"I like that attitude," said the long-haired man. "Very pragmatic."
"We see things similarly, Cater. But don't worry. The only thing likely to overwhelm me is Stinky's old man smell."
"That bad?
Friend, be glad you're not a pig."
The guards went on ahead. Just before they went out of sight, they shot Snowdrop a questioning glance, but she waved aside their concerns, shaking her head at their overprotectiveness. "You're taking a risk, all the same," I said.
"We haven't had visitors in 6 years,
Snowdrop answered, taking us along a connecting hallway where the gravity remained constant.
"It makes them twitchy, dealing with new faces. But you're who you say you are."
She had an awkward, waddling gait, as if her hip joints were fused. "If Pinky and Lady Arik are Glass's two associates," I said, "and if no other ship has come and gone from this system, then you must have already been here when Pinky and Lady Arik arrived from John the Revelator. How the hell is that possible?"
"Well, I won't say it was a picnic, Stinky. Anyone you see here is, by definition, a survivor, and most of us came through it with a few scars, inside and out."
"I don't disbelieve it. But we saw only ruins as we came in. No trace of life anywhere."
"If there was a visible trace, the wolves would have found it,"
so the trick is to not be visible. Easier said.
She patted one of the walls as we passed along it.
Several of us were holed up in this place. It's well shielded, so you can run basic life support and a few other systems without putting out too much excess heat and noise. Which isn't to say any part of it was easy. It was a cold, dark hell most of the time, just one step above being dead.
And the others?
Glass asked.
There are pockets of survivors down in Chasm City, or what's left of it. Wolves cratered it pretty good when they hit Yellowstone, blew out all the domes and pancaked most of the bigger buildings. Not much left that you'd recognize, but life clings on in dark corners and hideaways. Survivors, feral gangs, crime lords. None of it pretty, and none of it capable of lasting much longer. Breathable air, water, food, all running low. People turning sick and hungry. Any idea what people will do to each other when they turn sick and hungry?
The place I came from had its hardships. I said,
I bet it did, Stinky. I bet you sometimes went as long as a day between hot meals.
You don't know me, Snowdrop, I said warningly.
And you don't know any of us, she replied.
Glass said nothing. I wondered what she was thinking, and how warm and friendly was the reunion she was anticipating with her associates.